If anyone would like to have a conversation, we can start now. Great, thank you. You can feel free to come closer if you'd like. There's plenty of space. And then we won't have to bellow as loud. But also, if you're comfortable back there, that's fine too. Well, thank you again for coming so much. If anyone has anything that they would like to say about the ideas that we talked about, if you have any questions or things you'd like to talk about, please let us know.
Yeah, you talked about the stretch, how you fight, but which kind of interview you can relate to? I mean, how which content you want to transport?
Right.
Because for me, I would think that's of main importance how you fight and which group you fight. So.
Well, this is a. So the question is, what kind of content do we want to spread by the ways that we fight? And this is why I think it's really important that we make it clear that we're anarchists, that we're opposed to all hierarchies. You know, that we are not just against capitalism in some kind of broad left way, but that we are trying to abolish all kinds of control and domination, you know? And I think that this is important also because we are not the only ones who are against liberal democracy and capitalism, you know? This is a reason for anarchists to make it clear that if anybody is against capitalism, it is anarchists, you know? Because otherwise, if fascists have a more revolutionary program than we do, as capitalism starts to collapse, certainly there will be a lot of interest in fascism. Right? This is a reason for us to be sure that we are at the front of the fights, you know? And that when people think of fighting capitalism, that they think of anarchists, that they think of a struggle for liberation. I don't know if this answers your question.
Yeah. Because you related somehow to the revolutions in Egypt and
yeah.
Asia, and I think there are different contents promoted by the groups in
there. Well, yeah, there will be a lot of different groups fighting, in fact. You know?
The point of that example in talking about Egypt is not to say that the form that the struggle took in Egypt is exactly the form that we want to see happen in the U.S., or that the content or that the focus of the single demand of overthrowing Mubarak, but rather that what was most interesting about that struggle was the way that it inspired people around the world to fight through public occupations, through reclaiming space, through imagining revolutionary possibilities instead of just simple reforms. That this kind of logic is what we want to apply to the movements back home in the U.S.
In this way, maybe it's fortunate that the struggles against austerity started in Greece, you know, in 2008, rather than that the first example of what it means to fight against capitalism in Europe comes from a place that has a really strong fascist movement. You know. But somebody over here has to do that?
Yeah.
Please.
After you have squatted that big building and made this specific act of resistance, have there been imitations of that? Did that lead to some similar developments in the U.S.?
The question was about if the action that we took squatting the building led to similar actions in other places. In the Occupy movement, in a few different cities, people attempted to occupy buildings, usually not as a part of the overall open Occupy group that had a public camp, but usually autonomous groups acting within or sometimes outside of those camps decided to try to take another step in struggles by occupying buildings. Generally in the U.S., this wasn't successful. Not many of the building occupations happened or were able to last at all?
Well, it depends on how you define success, but yeah.
Right. Not successful in the sense of achieving a goal of creating a social center or holding on to a building. But again, as we said, our goal here, what was success for us, wasn't creating a permanent autonomous center, although that certainly would have been nice. But when we think of, when we look back on the occupation in our town, what's exciting for us is the way that the possibilities of how people resist in our small university town seem to have shifted in a way that continued even after the building was evicted. Just as a small example, before the Occupy movement, before the building eviction, if we wanted to have a march, usually we had to apply for a permit from the police. And unless we had a really large group, the police would attack small demonstrations that took the streets. And now today, with the new context, with so many people angry about the police response in the eviction, and so many more people mobilized through the broader movement, 6 or 7 or 8 marches have gone by, and we've never even thought to ask for a permit. We don't even think about asking permission anymore, because our sense of what we are entitled to do collectively has shifted. So this is an example of the kind of shift that isn't a victory. It's not a reform that we can build on to revolution, but it is a way of opening our sense of what is possible that can allow us in the future to have even sharper struggles.
But to answer your question, though, I think our building occupation was maybe the second building occupation that came out of Occupy in the United States. And after it, there were maybe 20 more. So I think that it did contribute to that. There was another attempt to occupy a building in our town. That wasn't successful, but it inspired a larger group of people to take over the, to make a guerrilla garden around the building that we couldn't hold on to. A struggle that continued for many months after that, and it was more successful. So yes, that specific tactic did spread also.
What I was missing a little bit was a question, why does capitalism exist? I mean, everybody's against it. Like, there are more people against it than actually are able to, you know, holding it up. But a lot of people are not really against it because, you know, there's always a struggle between safety and freedom. And a lot of people choose safety over freedom and always will. And, you know, what created the middle class was, you know, the safety to know you have a job next year and in 10 years if you keep on to this. So I think that's like the biggest challenge is to give people the safety and the freedom for the future coming out from their struggle. I mean, it's nice to have a building, but, you know, they want to have it, and if it's taken away, it's gone. But telling them that, well, this building is just a building, there are another building, so you want to have it, just start again. And if you need another one, just start again. And going on like this, I mean, that's, you know, I think going more to the root of the problem of capitalism is like, you know, giving people both sides of what the word means and see that they can have both and don't have to choose one over the other.
I think the problem is actually that capitalism used to offer some people safety, but it offers fewer and fewer people less and less safety. If we, as anarchists, could offer people safety, well, we would have a better thing to offer them. But as we have less and less safety within capitalism, we also have less and less resources with which to demonstrate alternatives. It's not easy for us to make people safe either, you know? The thing that we can definitely offer people is the possibility to participate in a movement, you know, that's based on, like, mutual respect, dignity, you know, the possibility that we will care for each other. This is a different kind of safety than the safety of having a lot of material resources. Yeah. I hope that people's values will change as the old capitalist compromises become impossible. I'm not certain that they will unless we make a real effort to demonstrate the value of other values.
And then here again, the problem that capitalism takes those ideas and makes them feel like products. I mean, it's like how it started with DIY, and it's like here in Germany, it starts with micro factories, like your own boss, the whole thing of like the American movement started like, well, you can be your own boss, just like do one company thing, we support you as long as you play along the rules, you can have it all. And we'll always be like a challenge, like whatever you do, capitalism find a way to make money out of it.
I think that's the reason that we need to actually fight against capitalism specifically, in what I would call an insurrectionary way, rather than trying to find new innovations to survive inside it. I mean, for me, this is what brings me back constantly to like a struggle that involves clashes, confrontations, rather than just alternatives, But but this is also hard and not safe.
But what's about parallel structures like non-commercial places of companies, something like that, or organization that can
The question is about parallel structures inside of capitalism or alongside of capitalism that that demonstrate alternatives or that
that are non-commercial.
Non-commercial? In my experience in the U.S., the alternatives or the non-capitalist or non-commercial businesses, enterprises that are given the most support and that are most able to succeed are the ones that fit within the logic of capitalism the most comfortably, but rely on a consumer model of, well, if you don't like this nasty aspect of capitalism, you can purchase this other slightly less nasty aspect of it. So we have green capitalism and fair trade coffee and the solidarity economy based in alternative products and things like that. So,
but I don't mean like a capitalist business. I mean really non-commercial. I mean like community. I mean that's really basic and low, but like farm.
Right. Well, I mean, the farms that are able to pay their rent usually are able to last longer than the ones that can't. So you still are forced back into the logic of the system, over and over, and unless you actually are able to win some space through confrontation, I mean, even something like Food Not Bombs in the United States, which feeds a lot of homeless people, a lot of hungry people, I think that on the one hand, I am deeply and passionately invested in this, We have to distribute food, we have to distribute resources. And on the other hand, we have to do it in a way that threatens capitalism, because if we just take on the role of providing support to those that are suffering because of capitalism for free, this is capitalists would be thrilled for us to clean up the messes that they make. We have to, if we are cleaning up the messes that capitalists make, we have to do that in a way that makes us stronger and makes us more ready to fight against them and take resources back from them. If somebody wants to give me a farm, great, but in fact they don't in the US. They would sell me a farm for millions of dollars,
Creating alternative institutions and non-capitalist ways of creating and distributing the things that we need. Of course this is important, and of course we should put energy into it. One of the reasons why we focus in this talk not so much on that, on sort of prefiguring the new world or on alternatives that we can start now, and instead focus on the struggles against capitalism and strategy, is partly because it's what we spend time thinking about and analyzing, but partly because building off of what Brian was saying, I don't think what we're lacking, at least in the U.S., it's not ideas. It's not visions of what we could do with our resources and how we could live our lives outside of capitalism. It's actually creating the space to be able to start. So,
right.
to me, what seems most pressing, what seems most important, is to just, to begin the process of conflict, of redistributing resources, of opening up spaces of possibility, where we could actually make some of those experiments happen and be able to defend them.
Yeah, it's not possible to coexist with them. They destroyed all of the people who were living according to another logic, actually. Have been colonized and destroyed by capitalism. So it's more of a question of how to defend the free spaces we create. But I mean, of course, it's both. Anybody who hasn't said something yet want to get in on this?
I was thinking how I...
Be loud enough they can hear you in the back.
Okay. How I understand the point, what you said at last, that the presentation was that how to spread the tactic, no?
Right.
More or less. But always the tactic is, how I saw in your example, is that it is connected more or less to the territory, no? Mm-hmm. And... because, I mean, territory or free space always gives you the possibility to express, to live freedom and to enjoy freedom and to create freedom, no? And, I mean, there's a new phenomenon, or it's not that new, but it's kind of big right now. It's kind of what refugees are doing, no? Mm-hmm. They're going through the world without a stop, and they go and go and go. And it makes the world more or less kind of uncontrollable. Mm-hmm. At least for some of the rulers, no? And what is about that, to find to find perspective in that of when we are not able anymore to create a territory which is fixed, which is placed in one space, and it will be always there and we can fight it, because obviously, we had an armed struggle, you had armed struggle everywhere in the Western world, we had armed struggle. I mean, there's not really like a possibility to keep space free of hierarchy or of ruling class or whatever our enemies are, or whether we are ourselves. I mean, you can't fight it without armed struggle. So, but armed struggle, is it really the solution? Finally, no? So there must be a different tactic. And the tactic could be, that's what I was thinking. What kind of place has the space which is in move, which is moving, which is not keeping it fixed onto something. But in the same way, I'm a kind of realist, and I say, hey, we need food, and we need, we need friends we have from the beginning of our lives to the rest of our lives, no? And how to connect those things, like to have the stability of food and friends, but on the other side, we're not able to have a fixed territory, so we need like a territory which is moving, which is faster than the hierarchy can follow us, no? And can chase us, and I can't really form it into an action, because the only action I see are the refugees, and the refugees in the same way are really fucked persons, because I mean, they force so much violence all the time, but in the same way, they're the ones who are doing it. Also, when there's violence. Yeah. That's how this thing is seen. And it's a hard question. But, yeah. Sometimes, yeah. I would like to see the anarchists going into this direction to watch what is possible there when we just move and never stop. And as well, we leave away our identity, our passport. When we can. When we don't can. Perhaps we don't can, but we can try it. No? This is what I always thought. But it as well means to leave our hardcore bag behind, no? Yeah.
Yeah. I think there's a lot in there. And one way for me to see what you're saying is that we need to focus on the things we do that are about circulation, you know?
Yeah.
That are about the ways that ideas and connections spread. You know? And resources, yeah. Spreading the resources so they don't accumulate in one gated community like Sweden. Be loud enough that they can hear you in the back.
Sorry?
Be loud enough that they can hear you in the back, sorry.
Okay, I just wanted to clarify what you said and also like make some points out of it. I mean, you were speaking a lot about this Greece.
Yeah.
This one thing. I mean, you mentioned like Greece two times, and also this kind of relation of this Arab Spring.
Mm-hmm.
And I would like to make a point here. Do you believe that this Arab Spring is like a kind of progressive thing, and why? This is one question. And the second question is, what's your position? I read you for years, so I know that you are not, of course, certainly not like a pro Islamist fundamentalism or something
mm-hmm.
like that, but. Do you see anything progressive after this kind of Arab Spring? Because it's one of the questions. And the other thing, that maybe here is a small critique, is that in Greece, there is nothing progressive to you speak about.
Yeah.
And I want really to stop this kind of really mess with this spectacle, this commodity, that Greece is a very progressive society.
Mm-hmm.
Greece is a very Nazi society. And Greece at the moment is really turning right wing. And we have to think about it, what's wrong.
Mm-hmm.
So I fear this kind of thing. Also, Germany is a very special background, a very unique background about the history of this country, which is probably, I feel, a bit more concerned.
Mm-hmm.
So, and if you have to build an anti-capitalist strategy, as you said, also you have to question what is anarchy or what anarchy was in the past, and what Orthodox communists were also.
Yeah.
And how actually to move beyond this kind of traditional way of anti-capitalist struggles or movements, and maybe building a different kind of critical theory or a different kind of strategy.
Mm-hmm.
And just to finish this point, I have some doubts if we have to unify the people and speak about the 1% or the 90%, or maybe split, not the people, but in the end, try to split this kind of traditional block that somehow remains a barricade to this to find out like a solution, like to go step forward to this kind of radical change that you also have as imaginary and also have it. So I don't know, this is my point from the discussion.
Okay, so one question was about the Arab Spring and the revolutions in North Africa and Western Asia, and if we think that these are progressive changes. I would say that I am not interested in a language of progress. That's not how I think about history. It's not how I think about revolution. I think that there are changes that are really interesting and have redefined the map of politics in that region a lot. They haven't resulted in societies that look like the utopias I would like to live in. I'm clear on that. But again, as we argued in the presentation, what we think is most interesting is not the result of the type of society that exists in Egypt now, with the way that the government is structured, the way the economy is structured, the way that religion is structured, but more that a new tradition of fighting that emerged from public occupations, mass protests, clashes with police and authority, and toppling governments has created a wave of momentum that's rippled through the whole world and given even us at home senses of possibilities that we didn't have before. So I guess I'm not sure if that answers your question directly, but... Yeah.
The thing I would say about this is that, you know, this new wave of fighting, is it necessarily a good thing? Will it necessarily bring us where we want to go? You know, December 2008 in Greece, will that necessarily produce an anarchist utopia if you do it long enough, right? Maybe not. I think that why we are looking at these spaces is to say that these kind of eruptions are inevitable in the future. And whether they go in an anarchist direction or a fascist direction will determine our future, you know? I don't think that there are any guarantees. I don't think that we can count on, historical materialism to convey us to a utopia if we just wait long enough for something, you know? That's not actually how things will work. unnecessary. The most interesting thing for me is the last thing that you say about whether we need to have a unitary movement or not. I actually think that that it's really important that we don't have a unitary idea of what we're trying to do. First of all, because it's not possible. Second of all, because if it turns out to be possible, it would be terrible. You know, the things that we've been involved in the United States have been repressed. There have been two kinds of repression, right? One is the kind of repression from the police. And then the other is the kind of repression from the rest of the social movements. People saying, it's not the right time yet. You have to try to get everyone to do the same thing together, you know? We have to wait until we're all ready. And this is a way to destroy diversity. And, you know, it's always a way to say, don't act, wait. You know, every time we hear this, and people say, oh, the way to overthrow a government is like what they did in, you know, Russia when they got rid of the communist, you know, system, or, you know, what they did in Poland or something, you know. Aren't those countries great now, you know? In fact, I think that we need to have a movement that can bring about a much longer-term struggle, a struggle over a much longer period of time, a movement that can create a bunch of diversity and different possibilities, you know, the possibility for lots of different ways of organizing our lives. And a movement that, even if one revolution doesn't make anything any better, like in Egypt, can keep fighting. Because one of the things that's interesting in Egypt is that after Mubarak was overthrown, there were still some people that I haven't met, but that friends of mine who've been in Egypt have met, who are still fighting for months, you know? And because of this liberal narrative that was forced on the events in Egypt, you know, with Obama saying, oh, it's great that they overthrew our ally, Mubarak, you know? And it's great that they did so non-violently, which is fucking bullshit, you know? This created a story where they're like, oh, now you have what you want, freedom, you know? So the people who are still fighting are just hooligans. We need to have a narrative that can last us through many revolutions, none of which may be enough. And a way of conceptualizing the struggle that doesn't force us all into one social body. Because the 99% is made up of a lot of different people who have reasons to fight each other also. I mean, the struggle against hierarchy happens inside every individual person, happens between all of us in this room, happens between people from different societies, you know? It happens on every level.
To build off of that, this 99%, 1% language in the Occupy movement, and the U.S., on the one hand, one thing that was positive about it was that it got people thinking about class and class conflict in a way that's uncommon in U.S. political discourse, where, on the news programs, you would hear people talking about the return of class war and things like this, which is just not language that you hear in the U.S. political spectrum very much. On the other hand, as we've talked about, obviously, like, this is not how I think about the problems in society, that there's a shadowy 1% holding the puppet strings at the top, and if we could just cut that head off, then all of a sudden we 99% would be free. No, that's bullshit. The demand for unity as the 99% in Occupy camps was often a repressive demand because it forced people to not look at the way that they were divided in hierarchies along lines of race in particular, along lines of class within the 99%, along lines of gender and the division of labor, and a lot of other things. So in thinking about this as it applies to our visions for a revolution, coming back to a point we made early on, and this might be controversial, but this is why I don't frame my politics as democracy, as anarchists trying to be more democratic than Democrats or whatever, is because I'm not actually interested in a world where instead of being governed by the 1%, I'm governed by the 99%. And so the possibilities of what I can do with my life are only within the bounds of what's acceptable to the largest group of people. I actually want to live in a world where power hierarchies are flattened enough that you can believe whatever you want, but you can't compel me by force to do what you think. And I don't want to build a society, a democracy, on the basis of that power. So this to me is the difference between democracy and anarchy, and one of the reasons why it's particularly important in fighting these struggles to share our visions of a world without hierarchy, and also to make sure that our tactics and our ways of fighting are spreading power outwards.
I don't know if that, does that answer your question?
Yeah, I'm thinking about it, so
okay.
I'll tell you another time.
Okay, great, great. Is anybody who hasn't said anything yet? Yeah.
You also asked about fascism.
Right.
Yeah. I don't know how it's in the USA, but what he told me about the Greece is like there's a very big fascist movement, and what I don't know about the German is like if here would be like a ground crisis, if not yet,
yeah.
but perhaps in 2 years, there would be a really big fascist movement, I think.
Right, right,
and,
of course.
I think it's really important to talk about this.
Yeah. And this is why I was saying that. Well, okay, definitely, if there's an economic crisis in Germany, there will be a stronger fascist movement. Yes, really strong. And there probably will be an economic crisis in Germany, right? So one way to respond to this is to say, oh, let's not hope there will be an economic crisis. But this answer doesn't prevent there from being an economic crisis, right? Another way to respond is to say, we should stop being anarchists. We should build a united front against the enemies of social democracy. This is not actually what we're saying, you know? Because we don't think that a united front is stronger. And also because we think that when it becomes clear to everyone that social democracy is a sinking ship, that we will only be, anarchist struggle will only be interesting to people if it seems like what we are proposing is more revolutionary, you know, is actually going to take us away from the problems that social democracy has. I don't think that we will be more convincing than fascists by saying that, you know, oh, we're just going to protect what's happening now, because what's happening now is obviously going to come to an end, you know. This is a reason for us to have a more convincing and a more beautiful revolutionary vision, right? Please.
Yeah. There is not so much for me of controversial points, because I'm on a lot of points with you when it comes to contents and your analysis and also your goals. And as I got it, you think that a very important goal on what you focus is to inform people about different possibilities of resistance. Yeah. So maybe. I have 2 points. Detail, do you think that it's not important at all to watch what you consume, so the point of consumption? For example, for me, it's important that I don't consume things which are made under bad, unhuman circumstances.
Right.
Though capitalism is unhuman, but yeah, there are differences still. And the second point is, when it comes to your political tactics to inform people, do you think it is good to go in places like this place, where you inform people who already are somehow connected to leftist perspectives? So I just thought about, wouldn't it be better if you'd go to some other places, maybe at universities or schools,
yeah.
where there are more people who don't know about other options?
On the question about consumption and consumer politics, again, in the U.S. context, when people began to make demands attacking capitalism for the most horrifying aspects of it, child labor, sweatshops, factory farms, you know, pollution, the way that capitalism responded was to offer alternatives alternatives that continue every bit of logic of the market, every bit of material privilege at the expense of others, but presumably free of some of those most extreme kinds of contradictions. But at least in the US, most of the companies who own these alternative companies also own the standard, you know? It's the same factory farm, you know, meat corporation that owns the tofu companies and these sorts of things. So to me, you know, you can buy your coffee from, you know, a slave labor plantation, or you can buy it from the Zapatistas. But to me, that's not a political or an economic question so much as kind of a spiritual question. You know, if it helps you feel like you can live in integrity with your values in such a way that you can fight against capitalism more effectively, then great, I support it. But to me, it does not seem like it breaks with the logic or the material reality of capitalism in a fundamental way.
So, okay, for example, I'm vegan, right? And, you know, veganism on the one hand it works as a consumer trend, because it means that you can sell soybeans for more than you could before, you know? Because they now have a new value. They're saving the world. Powerful little soybeans, you know? So yeah, I don't think that, you know, on the one hand, I don't make a big deal about being vegan. You know, I'm not like, go vegan, people, that's the first thing, and then be straight edge, the second thing, you know? Even if vegan straight edge actually is the way I do things, you know? Because I don't think those are the most important things. I don't want to create new values that can be used by corporations to make new profits. But yeah, I'm vegan because that's part of my personal practice of staying sensitive to the suffering that's inflicted in the world around me. You know, having a vegan diet, I guess it makes it easier for me to feel every day like I want to, you know, just do something fucking crazy. You know, to like try to like challenge this situation, you know. And what was the second question? I just got hung up on this vegan straight edge thing.
Shall I repeat it?
Just say a word and I'll remember.
Yeah. Is this a good place to spread?
Oh yeah, yeah, right. Yeah. You know,
are all of you converted?
Yes.
Yeah.
So we're ready to go right now and, for example, occupy a place that we don't work and shut it down, or fight the police, or I guess this happens every day in Berlin. Okay. Well, that's good. Good. I mean, it's been my experience that in Germany, more than almost any other place that I've been, that there is a big left movement, but that it is in a bubble. You know? It is in a specific space. You know, and that it doesn't spread very much, right? You know, one of the tours that I've been on talking about these issues, when Occupy started, two of us went around the southeast part of the U.S. where there's not much counterculture or left politics. We spoke at all these occupations to a bunch of different people, many of whom had never thought about this stuff before. And people were, this was really important. People were like, how are we going to do something? I don't know what, but let's do something. And what is it? You know? And for me, this is the most important place for us to be. If somebody wants to arrange an event for us in Berlin where we're speaking in some kind of place outside of the bubble, great, you know? I mean, I think it's really important to always be practicing how to talk. If you're at a bus stop, you know, how would you talk to the other people at the bus stop? We need to destroy capitalism before the fucking bus comes. What are we going to do? And so it's like, what? You know, to be able to have these conversations, you know? And maybe in Germany, the most important thing right now is not to protect the bubble or to clean things up inside of the bubble, you know, but to challenge the stability of the social system that keeps the left a bubble while there are other spaces that, you know. I mean, to put this another way, at many of our speaking events in Germany, the response that we have from people is like, you're talking about organizing with normal people, but normal people are racist and sexist. I don't want to organize with racist, sexist people. Which for me, first of all, a lot of the people on the left are racist and sexist, in fact. you know, I'm probably racist and sexist in some ways that I haven't figured out yet, you know. And second of all, if you never talk to people, what do you expect, you know? If you have some good idea that they could learn from, you're never going to learn from it, you know? So this, like, opposition to normal people, I think, is a real problem. If we're talking about circulation, like you were saying, or destabilization, that definitely means making connections in places that they wouldn't be normally. That's the first thing we have to do, right? Because who decides the winner of a revolution? It's not the people on either side. It's the people in the middle, you know? It's the direction that they go.
And another brief point on your question is that just that reason is why many Crime Think books, Crime Think pamphlets are not oriented specifically towards other anarchists, using language that will mostly be understandable to other anarchists, but towards wide groups of people. And the outreach that's done, past speaking tours, in terms of distributing literature and things like this, is largely oriented towards people who don't share our ideas or don't know what they think.
Yeah, we're trying to be controversial. Perhaps tonight we have failed.
Maybe one or two more folks want to speak or ask questions, and then we can march somewhere and do whatever it is we do in Berlin.
How about making the bubble grow? So, like, the bigger the bubble is, like, I would call it the bigger the parallel structure is, the more possibilities that it offers, and the more reachable, like the more those alternative ideas become reachable for other people. If you just talk about it, people might not believe in it, but if they can touch it, you know, they might believe in it.
This is a good question. We've talked about this in English, the expandable bubble model, you know? And then, you know, so you make your punk scene get bigger and bigger until it's just about as big as a punk scene can be. And then what? You know? This goes back to whether what we're doing is unitary, you know? Of course, the little bubble that I'm in, I would like it to be a little bit bigger. You know, I'd have more options for who I could date or something, you know? I mean, something like this. But I think this is the wrong way to think, you know? And it's like what Nikita was saying. We don't want to make the anarchist movement of people who call themselves anarchists bigger necessarily. We want to make anarchist ways of acting and relating to each other catch and spread, you know? I think that's much more likely to go further. Because as soon as we're just defending a fixed territory, really it can only shrink, you know? I think that even the spaces that I've been invested in, our info shop, or, you know, our permanent institutions in our town, they usually grow bigger when we challenge the relationships in the town itself. They don't necessarily grow bigger. You can put up 1,000 flyers for the info shop, you know, and 10 more people come in, right? But if there's some kind of crazy building occupation and the fabric of society is threatened, then everybody will come to the info shop to see what's going on. A hypothesis. Anybody who hasn't spoken yet? Does anybody want to say anything before we finish?
Well, thank y'all so much. We appreciate your time and your attention. We have a few books and magazines if you'd like to look at them, and also some free stuff. And we will be here for a couple of days, so if you want to hang out or you want to talk more, please come talk to us and talk to each other. Thank you so much. Yeah.